from your sleep. Rise to a new day with each your soul to keep. Come, my children, time to awake from your sleep. Rise to a new day with each your soul to keep. Do 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 do.
Hello and welcome to the Enlightened Medicine Show with Dr. Valerie Olmsted, the holographic physician. And as usual, let's get the business part out of the way first. And that would be thank you to Hydramay Skin Nutrition for being our wonderful sponsor. And you guys, if you haven't tried it before, and if you're a new listener to the show, let me tell you, you got to try this stuff. It's organic skin nutrition. It actually penetrates, leaves your skin soft, and I am a big fan. So I'm very grateful to Hydramay Skin Nutrition and Marjorie for supporting the show. And if you have any questions about it, please drop me a line. I'd be happy to tell you guys all about it and my experience with it. I'm using it for about a year now. It's the only thing that I use on my face, and I have used $400 a jar skin creams, and they didn't come up to this. So I'm pretty happy with this. Anyway, our show tonight, you guys need to buckle your seatbelts and hang on and put on the cone-shaped hat, which actually was never for dunces. It was actually to help you to channel in the energy, because tonight is going to be one of those wild nights. And my special guest tonight is Jim Elvidge, and his book is The Universe Solved. So welcome to the show, Jim.
Thank you very much, Dr. Valerie. It's great to be on the show.
Yeah, this is going to be fun. I love your book, and I have to tell you that as I read this book, I thought, you know what? If I were Jim Elvidge, I would have written this book. Yeah, that's kind of an inside joke, people. When you read the book, you'll understand what I was talking about. So first of all, let me have you go ahead and give a bio about yourself, Jim.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. I'm glad you enjoyed the book. My background is originally engineering, so I was electrical engineer by education and did the usual kind of, you know, software development career path, which I'm currently involved in as well. But at the same time, I've always had a great deal of interest in physics and cosmology and what makes the world tick, what makes what happens when you look deeper and deeper into the atom and all of those kinds of things. And it's kind of led me into some interesting directions. I hope that I've maintained an open mind and I've tried to read a lot of different kinds of books, some of the non-scientific mainstream books. And that background, basically, combination of the technical background and the other information that I've gathered over the years, really just kind of led me naturally to write the book like this. I'd also mention too that on the side I'm a musician. I love music and photography and quite a few other things that are probably in common with a lot of your listeners.
Well, you know, having read your book now, I have to say too that as you're talking about your background, except for the electrical engineering part, the thing that impressed me so much was you have the same understanding as I do and several other people about the nature of the universe, only you have the background to put it together, you know, in a more precise scientific manner, whereas mine is intuitive and based upon my near-death experiences and things like that. So I was very excited to read your book. And by the way, listeners, it is a real easy read. You've done a marvelous job, Jim, of the way that you've put it together. I couldn't put the book down. It was fascinating.
That's great to hear.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I think it's interesting. I noticed that there's one part of the book that talks a lot about East versus West. So, you know, we're used to Western philosophers, and kind of discovering the Eastern world has really happened a little more to us in the last 100 years or so. But there are so many things that kind of a confluence of different points of view that really lead to the same The same ideas. So Edgar Cayce, Buddhism, some of the New Age schools of thought. There are a lot of different directions that people have come to and come to kind of the same conclusions, that there's more to this universe, there's more to people than, just the kind of scientific reductionism that, a lot of, a lot of scientists actually believe in. So, I found that kind of interesting as I did my research, that it wasn't just, one group of people or one kind of domain of knowledge. There are quite a few, and they all led in the same direction. So even people like Brian Weiss, who's done regressive hypnotherapy, came to some of the same conclusions that Edgar Cayce came to 100 years before. And none of this was anything new to Brahmins and mystics and people who have studied Eastern religions.
Yeah, and that's something that I noticed when I first got into firewalking years ago as a spiritual practice with a spiritual healing group. I was amazed at the divergent backgrounds of everyone, and yet we all came to the same conclusion. So I think what you've hit on here in your book is that there is this universal truth that no matter where you start out, you're going to end up there because it's part of the program. And before we give away the whole thing about the book, there were a couple of other things that I wanted to have you explain to people. And the first one was you have a theory in there about, well, not necessarily your theory, but the theory that you're discussing about how we are just one person and that everything just kind of exists as kind of like the holodeck. And you're playing in the holodeck, and I thought that was a whole fascinating concept, which I've often thought about, especially out in the wilderness. So I'd appreciate it if you'd kind of address that a little bit, and then tell the joke that you've got in the book about Frank, the philosophy graduate student. That'd be great. I love that.
Oh, if I can remember that, yeah, sure. There's a kind of a lot of aspects to that. I mean, one. A lot of people have thought about the idea of solipsism, of, am I the only person in the world that has a free will? Could everybody else just be playing a role in my life? And, I don't know about you, Dr. Valerie, but when I was young, I thought about this a lot, because it just, I couldn't fathom the idea that, other people could be having the same kinds of thoughts as me. And I started thinking, gee, I wonder if I'm in some kind of program or in some kind of simulation, everybody else is just playing a role, kind of Truman Show-like. But that has some analogies in some of the theories that people have had. Bruce Lipton, for example, talks about how the cells of the body, we have 50 trillion cells in our body, and each one of those cells is a kind of a living entity. And each cell doesn't really need a nucleus or what used to be thought of as the brain to survive. Instead, the cells have a little tiny flagellum on the surrounding the cell that seem to be like antennas, like they're picking up information. Well, if you extend that a little bit and you realize, well, we're 50 trillion cells that are all getting this kind of information from somewhere, where is it coming from? And if humans are really just the sum of the consciousness of 50 trillion cells, then could the Earth then be the sum of the consciousness of all the living entities on the Earth? And is there a way to sum up consciousness? And so some of these ideas are really kind of interesting and kind of mind expanding. And they actually, the book covers that in quite a bit of detail.
Yeah, and I love the way that you covered it, because you brought in all these different philosophies and experiences of different types of people, and I just found myself laughing all through the book, because I was like, you know what, this is a book that if I'd had your background, I would have written this same book. And I thought it was pretty funny, as I thought about that, and I was looking at your discussion on solipsism, and I was going, yeah, I got to say that, because...
Oh, sure.
Because really, I've had the same thought.
Yeah, and as far as Frank is concerned, the joke goes like this. Frank, a philosophy graduate student, was a solipsist. One spring break, all the other graduate students got together a collection and funded an expensive vacation trip for him. One of the faculty was puzzled by this apparent display of altruism and asked one of them why they funded a vacation for Frank. And the response was simply, well, if Frank goes, everybody goes.
I love that. And I just thought that was perfect. I hadn't heard that one before, by the way, so I thought that was really wonderful. But it really does bring up an important point. And that is, you know, so many religions say, yes, we are one. And I've had that oneness experience myself where my consciousness exploded and I was in 35 other people all at once. And simultaneously knew the thoughts and the feelings of each one of those people about me. And it just cracked me up. I laughed for days. I just couldn't stop. It was hysterical. And so I thought, you know, coupled with an experience that I had when I was in high school, where I actually saw myself as a robot, and I saw the sky or the ceiling open up over me, and it was like I was in a lab, and these scientists were working on me. And they were huge. And I was just this little robot thing. And I was so surprised by this. And I remember after this little episode was over, and I was conscious through the whole thing, after the episode was over, I got up and I said, son of a bee, we're just robots. And everybody looked at me like I was crazy, and I said, I had no idea that I was just a robot. But then again, how would you know?
Right, and I think those kinds of experiences, and believe me, I would love to have that because, you know, that's the kind of thing that convinces you. I mean, people see, hear about out-of-body experiences or near-death experiences or UFOs even. I mean, things that are just like outside of the normal realm of belief of the average person. And it doesn't matter how many people tell you, how many statistics you read about it, how many articles you read about those things. You don't truly, truly believe it until it happens to you, right? So,
yeah.
I mean, I think that's great that you had that experience. It really had to be very, very eye-opening and mind-expanding for you.
Well, I had quite a lot of those kinds of things going around. You know, as soon as I hit puberty, it was kind of like everything broke loose. You know, and so I was doing, you know, moving matter with my mind, teleportation, bilocation. I mean, you name it, I did it. And I had no one to talk to, unfortunately, and so I put all that stuff away and just quit doing it after a while because it was getting pretty scary and people were starting to look at me really funny, you know, as you can imagine. And as I got, you know, back into my own spiritual path many years later and was taking meditation classes, I remember talking to a couple people about some of these things, and they said, well, you know, there are beings who, I'm trying to remember what they call them. They might have called them Mandingos, but they said that these beings were shaman in native tribes, not just here in America, but over in Siberia, you know, wherever there were shaman, which is every tribe, basically. And they said that these beings understood the content of the universe so completely that they then began to build universes inside of people. And one of my teachers that told me about this said he'd actually had to inform the Mandingo that they had chosen a living, conscious human being when they planted the universe inside of them and it was killing them. And he said they're very apologetic because they don't mean to harm anybody. But he said what happened was they became so powerful because they opened up to the universe and they took the teachings of, you know, how to create. And he said they were actually ostracized by all of their tribes. And so then they you know, had to go live apart and they took up residence basically and, you know, created universes. And I thought that was so interesting in light of things that you had said further on in the book about shamanic people and about the universe and the actual construct of the universe and about all these things that we would call magical. And I love that you put it in layman's terms so that people could actually start to get a handle on this. I think you presented it in a really nice way. And just the whole aspect of all of these divergent ideas about the universe and who we are and where we came from, you wrapped it up really nice.
Oh, good. Thank you. I was afraid at some point that it might be a little bit of a hodgepodge of a lot of different ideas, but it really did seem to all make sense in context of a whole. So I've got to do some more research on the Mandingo. That's very interesting too.
Yeah, it was interesting because the guy said that the, you know, my first question, of course, being somewhat analytic, is how do you know if you have one of these inside of you? And he said, oh, you'll know. He said the first hint that you'll have, besides the fact that your belly or your chest will expand, he said in women they build the universe in the uterus, and in men they build the universe in the chest. And he said what happens is your chest or your belly starts to expand so much it becomes painful. And he said when it starts to get to the point where you're about to be eaten up because it's using your life force to create this, he said what happens is you start to see night and stars even in the brightest daylight. And he said at that point you need to see some kind of shamanic practitioner. He was actually a Tibetan Lama. And so he had said, you know, you would be coming to me because he said you would see the dark night sky and stars every place, even at high noon.
Fascinating.
Yeah, I thought that was real fascinating, especially in light of where you're talking about the bubble universes.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
You know, when you went through the levels 1, 2, 3, and 4, if you would address that, the multiverse thing, I think that would be fascinating for a lot of people.
Sure. There are a lot of different ways to come at the idea of a multiverse. And one way is sort of in a large scale. If we think about, I mean, even if you believe in the sort of traditional theory of the Big Bang Theory, how the universe was created, you realize that it could have been created and generated such a huge amount of matter and space that we just can't perceive because of something called, you know, the limitation of the speed of light. So when we look out into the sky, we can only see as far as the speed of light can travel to our eye. So if you see something, for example, that's 13 billion light years away, the speed of light, you know, it would take 13 billion years for light to go that distance to your eye. Scientists tell us that the Big Bang occurred 13.7 billion years ago, so therefore there's only a certain distance that you can see when you look out. You just can't see beyond that distance. Doesn't mean that there's nothing else out there, and a lot of mathematicians and logicians and astrophysicists have speculated that, yeah, there probably is something else out there. It could have been formed from our own sort of instantiation of the universe, and maybe beyond our ability to see, there's a whole nother set of galaxies and stars and planets. And we'd call that a different universe because we can't tap into it. We can't see it. And there could be hundreds, billions of those things that were created from our own little primordial, you know, instantiation of the universe. But in addition to that, who's to say that there wasn't another one, you know, some miles down the road, metaphorically speaking, other universes that created in the same way. So, you know, and part of the reason why they suspect that this is the case is that when you look out into space, it's a lot more consistent than they would otherwise think. If there was lumpiness and sort of you know, differences in different directions that you looked in, then that might imply that, yep, we can pretty much see everything. But when it's all spread out nice and even, then there's sort of the assumption that, boy, you know, it must be way beyond where we're looking for it to be as flat as we see. So they use these kinds of ideas to speculate, you know, how big is the multiverse? How many universes are there out there? And, you know, there's some interesting thought experiments that you can do. There are only so many ways that you can put, you know, atoms into a construct of a universe. So therefore, ultimately, there must be other universes that are exactly like ours, that have an identical person to me or an identical person to you. And then it turns out those, you know, speculative universes are unimaginably far away, but a lot of people believe that that's all very likely and very possible. So that's sort of the large-scale way of looking at how the multiverse could exist. But there's another one that is a very in a very small scale something called quantum mechanics, which is the prevailing theory of physics that explains how particles interact and come into being and things like that. You know, submicroscopic particles that we can't even see, basically the building blocks of matter, of everything. And there's a theory that when these particles make a decision to move one direction or another, or to have a certain kind of spin or another, or any property that they might have, that instead of the traditional view of physics, which was there's a probability that they'll do both things, instead of that view, there's something called the Everett interpretation of quantum mechanics, which says that they actually both happen. And each time a decision is made, one of these little, you know, microscopic particles on which direction it should go, it actually goes both directions. In one direction, it creates one universe, and then when it goes the other direction, it creates another universe. So at any given time, there's zillions and zillions of these universes just being spawned with all slight differences, you know, in different directions. Now, it turns out, believe it or not, that most physicists actually believe in this model, and it just sounds, to me, it sounds mind-boggling, you know, to think, in a way, why would the world be so complex? You know, why do we need to generate so many, you know, zillions and zillions of universes within every, you know, microsecond? Or why does it have to be as large as it is? Is it really that large? And when the more I thought about that, the more I thought, it doesn't have to be. In fact, you know, if the world is under a program control, and there's a lot of evidence that it is, and that's really what the book is all about, it doesn't have to have all of these aspects to them. It only has to have those aspects to them when people start investigating, when they start looking into it. It's kind of like, I don't know if you're familiar with some of the large-scale video games that people play online. They're fantasy games. There's a whole scenario. It might be sort of a medieval scenario, or it might be contemporary. But people have what's called avatars, or sort of representations of themselves on the screen, and they can interact with other people. You can be, you know, talking to somebody on your computer screen, and that person that you're seeing yourself talk to is really being controlled by somebody in Japan or somebody in Europe, you know, far away. You have no way of knowing which computer it's being generated from. But the idea is, in these games, there are, you know, constructs. There are, you know, buildings and trees and you know, sky and all kinds of things. And that is created programmatically. It's created by the software that is running the game itself. We all see it when we play the game. We all experience it. But it's really being driven by something else. And the reason that that's interesting is because if you take something like an empty room that nobody's been in one of these games, does that room have to be designed inside of it? Does there have to be any kind of, you know, ornate molding on the ceiling or the walls? Does it have to have anything in it at all? No. If nobody can get into it, it doesn't have to have anything in it. But as soon as somebody finds a door or finds a key to the door to go into that room, then, by gosh, it better have something in there, or people are going to say, hey, you know, what's going on here? This is a bug in the program. You see what I'm saying? So, yeah, I feel the same way about our reality. You know, the deeper and deeper we peer into space, the more that reality has to get created for us. And it turns out that physicists have actually proven that reality doesn't exist until you observe it. And that proof is, you know, one of the kind of tantamount arguments behind this whole programmed reality model. If things don't exist until you observe them, why is that? You know, maybe it's because of this mechanism that I just talked about, the computer gaming mechanism, where it doesn't exist until you observe it because it doesn't have to. We're saving something. We're saving, you know, memory or saving computing capacity by not generating this until somebody really opens that door and needs to see it, or until somebody builds a telescope that's big enough to peer out, 10 times further than they previously have, then at that time, we better have something there for people to look at. And that really seems to be the way the world evolves and the way science has been evolving.
Let me ask you a question then. Do you believe that there are glitches in the program?
The definition of the word glitch is a real important one. A glitch, to me, kind of implies that that it's a mistake in some way. And like in the movie Glitch in the Matrix, they referred to deja vu as being an example of a glitch in the Matrix, which was a glitch in a big program. My thinking is that, and again, I'm not 100% sold on this idea, even though I wrote a book about it. I'm a kind of a gray person. I don't see black or white. I always see shades of gray, and I see levels of truth and all that kind of thing. So I think there's a lot of evidence that this is really what's behind the universe. And the book goes into that in detail. But, you know, having said that, I will say that I speculate that if indeed this is true, that we are in a programmed reality, then that program has to be incredibly sophisticated. Just to think of, you know, the sheer size, the sheer capacity of the program, all of the things that have to keep track of, everybody's conscious thoughts, everybody's intent, all those things, in order for it to generate the, you know, the continuous stream of the universe that we see. So if it's that complex, it must have been developed by a civilization or an entity that is way beyond the complexity of us. In so being, it's unlikely that they would have those kinds of bugs in the software. I think more likely a glitch is an intentional path of the software that allows you to get a glimpse into reality, get a glimpse into true reality. You tapped into it, and the story that you talked about in the beginning of this hour, you got a great glimpse into the reality. Not everybody is so lucky, and probably there's reasons because of it. It could have to do with the body that your soul is occupying and the way it's constructed, or it could have to do with just random chance in the program. In a lot of these gaming programs, they give people a random amount of intelligence and a random amount of strength and spirituality, and you can gain that, you know, through your actions as you go forward. But it's all, you know, given a little bit random, so that not everybody is the same. If everybody was the same in the world, it'd be pretty dull.
Boring.
So it would be boring, wouldn't it?
The reason I asked you is because I have had the same feeling that this is a video game for a long, long time. I knew it was a game, and then I started likening it to a video game, and then The Matrix came along, and I said, yeah, perfect. And the difference is that I don't believe that we're being, you know, used as batteries by some race machinery. But I've had such strange things happen in life, Jim. Like I've told people many times here that I was driving down the road in Sedona with a friend, and all of a sudden the road disappeared and all the cars and the people disappeared, and I was driving out across the desert. Now, if I had actually been driving across the desert, there would have been a lot of bumping and banging and, you know, rocks and things like that. But it was as if I was still on the road, and I was kind of, you know, my hands were frozen on the wheel. I didn't know what to do, because the road totally disappeared. And my friend sitting next to me after a couple minutes said, are you seeing what I'm seeing? I said, if you're seeing that the road has vanished and so have the people in the cars and there's nothing out there but nature, then yes, I'm seeing the same thing. She goes, what do we do? I said, I don't know.
She had the same experience.
Yeah, and we weren't talking about anything, and I swear to God, we were not doing drugs or smoking anything funny or, you know, no alcohol was involved. We were just going hiking. It was the middle of the day, and we're driving down the road, and all of a sudden, the road came back in, and it was like the two realities merged together, crossed through, and then all of a sudden, the road was gone again. And she kept yelling at me to stop. I said, I'm afraid to, because what if I stop in this reality? And then all of a sudden it phases back through, and bam, I get hit from behind. by somebody who didn't have this kind of experience. And she said, she kept saying, what do we do? I said, I have no idea. The next time it phased through, I pulled over to the side and stopped, and we both sat there hanging onto the dashboard, panting for about 10 minutes, going, oh, my God. She said, what was that? I said, I have no idea.
You know, I think the thing that's most interesting about that is that your passenger experienced the same thing that you did. I think that's fascinating. Do you stay in touch with her?
Oh, once in a while. It seems that whenever she and I are together, there's all kinds of dimensional slippage that happens. And I've talked on this show before about slipping through dimensions. The only way that I can tell that this has happened is something will be a little bit different. And it'll be something that I know was not that way in whatever dimension I've been in before. And so this is one reason why I found your book so fascinating when you talked about the multiverses and about time not existing and all this kind of stuff, because it's the only thing that makes sense to me, having had all these strange experiences. But I've had things where, you know, I'll be sitting there on the couch looking out the window at the mountain drinking my coffee, and all of a sudden notice that there's a brand new Rainbird sprinkler head on my defunct sprinkler system that was not there any of the 2 years before.
Mm-hmm.
And it freaked me out so bad I got up and I walked out there and looked at it, tapped it, and went, yep, that's a brand new sprinkler head. And I puzzled about that. And then the next day there were two of them out there. Now, I didn't have a gardener. I wasn't trying to fix that system. So unless somebody was purposely trying to drive me crazy or just playing a joke on me, then where did those come from? And then I noticed there were other little differences, too, where people do not respond to you the same way. Or maybe, you know, you remember something that nobody else remembers, and you go, okay, must have slipped dimensions again.
Yeah, those are all examples of things that can happen in a programmed reality, but they can't happen in the reality that we're told, you know, by the status quo exists. It has to be something like what I talk about in the book. Because, you know, the idea that different people might see different things can be perfectly explained by this gaming model. Again, going back to, you know, two different people playing a game, it's not hard to, for the software to say, oh, I know that Jim here is communicating with Valerie, and because Jim has a high level or a low level of paranormal belief and Valerie has a high level of paranormal belief, I'm going to put something into the reality that only she can experience and nobody else can. Or, you know what I'm saying? Or maybe both of us can experience at the same time, but nobody around us can. And these kinds of things are all very easily done with software, all very easily done with program control, and they completely explain anomalies like UFO sightings and things where, you know, many people see them and many people don't, or, you know, cryptozoology type sightings and, you know, strange coincidences, and the exact kinds of things that you're talking about too are perfect examples of what can be done if you're living under a programmed reality. But nothing else I can think of can explain that, all of that stuff.
Well, that's the thing that I found so fascinating, Jim, because as I read your book, I was going, you know, I have had lots and lots of paranormal experiences throughout my entire life. I mean, the things that you were naming, you know, the UFOs and the ghosts and the dimensional stuff and, you know, quantum strangeness and all, I've been there, done that, all of it. And so for me, as I read through this, I went, you know, that made perfectly good sense. And as I said, there are a lot of us that have come to the same conclusion that this is a game. And then I started thinking about it, you know, from the space of being a spiritual entity. If you are made in the image of one that we'll probably never see because it's so far away, we see step-down units, you know. And if you're made in that image of this great one that can do these amazing things, and you have eternity, and, you know, for all intents and purposes, our souls are eternal, unless we do something stupid, and, you know, disband them. But if you have eternity, what else are you going to do? You know, and I see it as God playing a game and partitioning off its own mind, its own consciousness, in order to really enjoy the game, and imbuing all of these parts with complete free will within the game, so that it can discover more about itself. The good, the bad, the ugly, the amazing, everything.
Exactly. Exactly. Yep. And the way that it works is, you know, it's very much the way ancient religions have kind of perceived it, which is the God, if you will, can know everything, can know all that people are thinking and experiencing and you know, all conscious entities are experiencing. The same could be said of a central program that is tapped into all of your sensory signals. So when I view something, you know, perhaps in my brain is a little transmitter that transmits this data, and this data can be all processed by the central computing unit.
Explain that a little bit more, if you would, too. Using the example you have in the book is about, was it Jessica? I think you used as an example, or Jennifer, or something like that, about how this person might or might not have control over their sensory functions. Because that was interesting, you know, seeing the different levels that you spoke of with that.
Sure, yeah. I put that in the book just to kind of give people the introduction to the idea that, hey, this whole idea is plausible. Because once you realize that it's plausible, then it all comes down to, okay, is it probable? You know, what evidence is there that we are in this kind of situation? So the plausibility argument goes like this. If you can imagine that, you know, our brains and our sensory signals do work this way, so, you know, when you see, when you feel, when you smell something, all of those signals go through nerve endings that end up at some part in your brain, the visual cortex or the olfactory cortex or whatever they're called. You probably know these names better than I do. But they're all electrochemical signals. Well, if you took at that point where they all come into the brain and you severed it, and instead of, you know, passing it through to the other side of the nerve endings, you send it off to, say, a computational unit somewhere. It could be even sitting next to you. And all that computational unit, all that computer does is just take those signals and send them right back to your brain. You would have no idea. You would have no idea that this is going on. It's impossible to know that something has intercepted these sensory signals that you're experiencing. Now, if that computer does nothing but just pass them on, then you're experiencing exactly what you think you're experiencing. But if, on the other hand, it messes with them in some way, if it interprets them and says, oh, hey, Jim is looking in the mirror now, or I used Jessica in the book, looking in the mirror, I'm going to play a little game on her, and when I see the signals coming in from her sight, that I can tell she's looking at herself in the mirror, I'm going to replace those with an image of a chimpanzee. And Jessica will look in the mirror, and she'll see a chimpanzee. And she'll raise her arm, and she'll realize her arms look like a chimpanzee as well, and she'll feel her face, and the computer will replace the sensory signals that correspond to a smooth face, feeling a smooth face with your hand. It'll replace those with feeling a hairy face. And so, if you think about it, this computer can really completely fool you into thinking you're a different individual or in a completely different reality. You're not really looking in a mirror at all. You're looking at something else. You could be laying down experiencing, you know, this whole reality a la the Matrix, the way they were in the Matrix. That's all, you know, something that's theoretically possible. And it boils down to a field of science called brain-computer interface, and boy, they're making just, you know, scary, experiments with this these days, and advances in the technologies. It's possible for blind people to see rudimentary grids of light that are just injected into their cerebral cortex. So we're very, very much kind of at the early phases of this idea in terms of our reality, and if you follow Moore's law, which is the kind of technology law that shows that technology tends to double every couple of years, if you follow that, you realize that in only about 20 years or so, we will have the capability to intercept all sensory signals and re-inject a completely different simulated reality into our brains. Okay, so if that's 20 years away, who's to say that that hasn't already happened? And the fact is, there's just no way to know. And so this is the plausibility argument. If you think about it, you realize, okay, there's really no way to know that that isn't happening now. And since we can actually erase memories, identify memories, inject memories, these are a little bit harder to do than just the sensory recognition and the sensory injection, but we're starting to make strides in those areas as well. If that can be done, then at some point, you know, Jessica looking in the mirror, her memory could be replaced with an entire history of growing up as a little chimpanzee, and she would never know the difference. And this is a bit of a scary thought to think about, but it's all perfectly plausible.
Well, you know, as you're talking about this, I'm thinking about what a couple of my physicist friends told me. I have friends in strange places, you know, and a couple of them have worked in that arena with controlling people's thoughts, and actually they've had the capability of doing this now for quite some time. And so, that's another thing I found fascinating as you were talking about this. It was like, yeah, you know, I know kind of, you know, I find things get brought to me, truths are brought to me from several different angles, and they all corroborate each other's stories, which is always fascinating to me because I don't know why I'm at the hub, but I am. So I get these things. And they've been talking about the ability to do that and to actually change your physical appearance by changing your belief system, and that they can do it quite easily now. And, for instance, in 5 minutes, you can change your gender. Just poof. No operation. All they have to do is change the way that your brain thinks and your body will respond. And that's pretty scary stuff. And, you know, when look into the mind control and the way that they've been experimenting with weapons that will beam signals that will interfere and cause pain and, you know, make you think you're burning alive and all this other kind of stuff. I mean, that's very scary stuff. And
it is
so
scary, go ahead.
Yeah, my question is always, you know, who's at the helm? Who is actually doing this programming? And what happens when you have someone like me and other people like me that do see the reality beyond that and are not susceptible to this programming?
I agree with you. It can be scary, but I get some comfort in the fact that we haven't destroyed ourselves yet. And that might sound maybe a little naive, but if you think about it, back in 1962, we were 2 seconds to doomsday. The doomsday clock because of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Everybody at that time, and I was just a child then, but everybody at that time really thought that we were going to have a mutual nuclear annihilation with the Soviet Union. And nobody could see a way out of it. I mean, they've got thousands of nukes pointed at us. We have thousands of nukes pointed at them. You know, all it takes is an itchy trigger finger and boom, you know, we're going to destroy the world. And it seemed like it was, you know, an impossible situation to get out of. And I remember as a kid thinking, I would like to invent something that, you know, knowing how physics works, you can make certain things inert by bombarding them with particles. So you could make uranium-235, which is at the core of all nuclear weapons, or plutonium, and you could make it inert by bombarding it with neutrons. So I'm thinking, is there a way that we could just generate this kind of shield over the Earth that just blasted out these neutrons? It wouldn't hurt anybody, but it would render all nuclear weapons inert. That was the only scenario I could come up with that was going to get us out of this mess. But it turns out something else happened. It didn't happen. Nuclear annihilation didn't happen. And people talked about the population explosion being a coming disaster in the 1980s, and that didn't happen either. you know, now people talk about nanotechnology run amok or artificial intelligence run amok. And I guess, you know, and people also talked about, you know, back in the Industrial Revolution that we were going to destroy the world. You know, Luddites had that theory. So I guess I have some comfort in the thought that the civilization-ending events never really seem to occur. They seem to reverse somehow, and there's probably a reason behind it, and it's probably because we need to maintain the program. We need to keep on going forward. You know, it's either that or the memories are being erased and we're starting over again. You know, it could be either of those two things, but whatever the case, it doesn't seem like a plausible scenario that we're all going to get annihilated and, you know, very soon.
Yeah, and that brings to mind another thing where you were talking about the coming merger, the Borg-like merger, basically, of humans and artificial intelligence and different bionic things and computer changes. And I was thinking about what a molecular microbiologist friend of mine had told me, that they found some of this goo that was coming down out of the sky, and he experimented with some of it, and he said it looked like five-pointed stars, and at the end of this of each point was a little round thing, like a pseudopod, and he said the things are oriented towards silicone, and he said it was scary, because he put them in a petri dish. And he said, you could walk in any direction, the entire colony of these things would, like, instantly orient towards wherever the silicone chip was.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I found that fascinating because, you know, people have been talking in the New Age community for years about how we're going beyond carbon-based beings and we're going to silica-based beings. And so I'm wondering, you know, what part of, you know, how do I connect all the dots on this? You know, we've actually got these things in our atmosphere that we're breathing in, that we're eating, we're drinking. It's all part of it. We have these things coming inside of us. We don't see them, and the body does not react to silicone. And so, you know, the body considers it to be just not even there. And so these things are going along. And then you put together the things like Morgellons disease, where not the parasite disease, but the nanobot disease portion of it, where they're talking about how these weird polyethylene fibers are growing out of people's skin. And when they go to try to take these things out, they're wrapped around the nerve channels. And they have like a little brain and a little digestive system and everything else. They're actually growing into nerve channels, but this stuff cannot be burned until you hit over 300 degrees Fahrenheit. And then you hear about things like, you know, the red rain that came down in India. And it's some kind of a biological organism, they think, but they can't penetrate the cell walls to see if there's DNA there, because you would have to get above 500 degrees Celsius in order to get this thing to do anything. And then it grows and replicates at that. So, you know, I look at all these things going on and I go, I think the Earth, it is a changing, you know, and so
yeah.
Are we.
Well, a lot of those things sound to me to be, you know, a little ways off in the future, but all very plausible. Nanotechnology is something that, you know, we're making advances by leaps and bounds these days. Which is the ability to build up things molecule by molecule that you couldn't otherwise do. And the idea of nanobots, you know, there's already been an invention now of nanobots that can go into the bloodstream and seek out, you know, cancerous particles, and they're talking about how to, cancerous cells, they're talking about how to poison those cells and leave the good ones standing. And you know that all of this stuff can be weaponized and it can be used for good or for evil. And it's just, to me, it's just another example of, you know, the kind of conflicts that we've been going through, over the past so many years. So is it happening now? Well, in our existing reality, it doesn't seem to be. But the technology to do that, given that it's only 50 years away or 30 years away, then the likelihood, if we're living in a programmed reality, then the likelihood that that technology is in that reality, in the real reality, is very high. So those kinds of things could very easily be integrated into our programmed world, if you catch my drift.
Yeah, and see, all that kind of stuff just goes back to, you know, what you were describing about the world is and how it works. You know, it's a pretty plausible theory because of that, because that's the only thing that makes all this stuff work. And kind of like, you know, the theory of everything that you're talking about that the physicists have been looking for forever. And you know, I really think this is the theory of everything, you know. Plus, there's so many people coming to that from so many different directions.
Right. I don't know if you noticed, there was an article that came out a couple weeks ago about a gravitational wave detector in Germany. And this is a device that's, 600 feet long or something underground, and it's extremely, extremely sensitive. And it's trying to detect perturbations in gravitational field that are coming from really, really distant astronomical cataclysms like supernovas or galaxies colliding or black holes being generated, something like that. Mm-hmm. So it's very, very sensitive. And what they found is there's noise in it. And the characteristic of the noise, they can't find the source of the noise in their measurements. They've ruled out everything up to this point, and the characteristic of the noise is such that it looks like the granularity of digitized stuff, you know, the granularity of your TV screen when you look at it, or the granularity of a model of a device in a computer game. It behaves the same way as that. So there are, you know, quite a few people speculating that, hey, maybe these guys have just stumbled upon the granularity of the universe. If they have, that proves it's digital. It proves that it's programmed. So, you know, when I first wrote the book, I thought, gee, how are we ever going to, you know, prove this theory? It seems to be a lot of, you know, circumstantial evidence and a lot of, you know, evidence like, well, every single anomaly is explained by it, and, you know, the world is quantized according to quantum mechanics, and the only reason it should be quantized is because it's programmed. But, you know, where do you find the proof there? This could be the proof. So it's a very interesting development.
That is so fascinating, it kind of makes sense, like I said, with all the mystical experiences that I've had and that I've talked about with other people. It makes perfectly good sense. And then, too, there's a thing that I read on this program about once a month or so. I read a fascicle or a chapter from the Knowledge Book, which claims to be the book that all the other books of religions and such come from. But they say in that book, well, we're a race of extraterrestrials, and we're actually you from way in the future, but right, not from this planet. And they tell you how the Earth actually works and how the universe works. And basically, they're saying the same thing. It is a program. But, you know, you're in this until your spirit evolves to the point where you're ready to go on to the next thing, and that there's no end. It just keeps on going and going and going. And you know, we have different programs at different levels, so it is like a video game. You know, you survive through this level and you make it out, and then poof, you're into another game. And exactly, they don't know who the creator is. They say, well, we have access to this set of creators, and this one is more high than that one, this more high than that one, and this is like the ultimate one in that we can see. But there are ones beyond that one that we can't even start to see.
Right. And you know how you talked about your sprinkler head scenario. If you think about another analogy to the video game world, in these massively multiplayer online role-playing games, they're run on different servers. So the same software is being run on different computers. You can actually jump from one to the other. There's no reason why your incarnation, if you will, can't go from one server to another. It'll run into a whole bunch of different people because those accounts, there's different accounts on different servers. But you could go to a different one, and the universe is going to look different because people have knocked trees down or you know, done different things. And you can certainly imagine that a different instantiation of, quote, the universe is going to look different because of whatever, you know, intent people had, whatever actions they took. So you popped in from one universe that had didn't have a sprinkler head, and you popped into another one that did. Why? You know, is it the, you know, your nature to do that once in a while because you are one of the few people who are being given the glimpse into the true reality? If everybody were given that glimpse, I imagine our world would be quite different. And it's the way it is probably because everybody is sort of kept in ignorance. And just a lucky few managed to get the glimpse into the real reality. So,
well, you know,
you're lucky.
Well, you know, you talked also about how a lot of this stuff starts when you have head injuries. I've had a lot of head injuries and started when I was very young. But before I had my first head injury that I know of, I also, you know, got visited by the aliens since I was three. And I was awake. I wasn't asleep. It was no kind of a dream. You know, I was so terrified. I didn't want to go to sleep. You know, maybe that was where I started with the whole night person thing, you know, but I mean, things like that have happened. And I mean, I've had other things. I think I've told this on the show before, but I was taking a nap one day in my house, and all of a sudden I thought I woke up and I heard noises in the family room. And so I creeped down the hall, you know, with the .45, you know, ready to blast somebody. And I peek around the corner, and there's a guy sitting there with two little kids and a grandmother. And the kids are saying, "Daddy, when's Mommy going to wake up?" And my first clue that I was someplace different was there was wallpaper on the walls in the hallway. I hate wallpaper. You know, so I'm looking around going, what the heck? My bedroom had looked exactly the same. But then when I opened the door and crept down the hallway, I saw the wallpaper. I looked in the family room's different family room. And as I looked there, I thought, oh, crap, I'm Mommy. And then I thought, oh, no, what am I going to do? So I crept back into the bedroom and closed the door and stood there and hyperventilated for a while. And I thought, I don't know what to do. You know, and then I thought, well, I slipped into this universe through my sleep.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe if I can go back to sleep, I could get back to my normal universe.
Get back to the other one, right.
And that's what happened. But do you know how hard it is to get back to sleep when you're panicked? So I had to do one of those out-of-the-body things, you know, and calm myself down. And then when I woke up again, it only took a few seconds, really. But I jumped right up, and I ripped open the door, and I crept out there really quick, and it was all normal again. I was like, oh, thank God.
Really fascinating.
Yeah, but it's so crazy when that kind of stuff happens, especially when it doesn't happen to everybody, because then people start looking at you like, yeah, okay, right.
Right.
and you know, I've had so many experiences with schizophrenics, and truly, they are extremely psychic. You know, and that's the problem. They can't turn it off. Whereas psychics can, you know, turn it off, go up and down the band, you know, pick the station that they want, you know, turn the volume up or down and turn it off. But the schizophrenics can't, and they're stuck in the lower bands. So I always thought it was fascinating when I discovered that schizophrenics were that way. And so in that section of the book where you were talking about famous schizophrenics and famous people who were actually autistic, it kind of rang a few bells, and I went, huh. So really they're experiencing the different reality that's overlapping to the point where they can't deal with this reality.
Right. And there are a lot of different ways that they can, that people have been able to experience this, you know, some, you know, not through their own volition, mental illness, schizophrenia, autism, things like that, but also shamans, you know, trances, ingesting certain drugs even, ritualistic drumming, all these kinds of things can get people into a state like that where they can experience all very similar alternate realities, which is, you know, an indication that there's something else going on there. If they were all experiencing something different, that'd be one thing, but there's some commonality.
Yeah, and I've been down in Central America and, you know, traveled with metaphysical groups, and I can tell you that that we were in the deepest, darkest jungle, and you know, in the middle of the night, we all had the same experience, and it was quite interesting because it was a palpable evil. I mean, you could have cut that air with a knife; it was that thick, and three of us experienced it. And we were just sitting there, And the guide that was with us had gone back to the cabin to get some munchies, and we were just kind of the three of us sitting there very quietly back to back, and something crept up on us and came to the edge of the lamplight and wouldn't come any further, and then it kind of like faded back, and it was such an evil presence. And I always wondered what that was, but there were three of us that were kind of lost in meditation and experienced all the same thing. And I've had that experience many times with other people in meditation. And with the quantum vortex thing that I do, the first time I played with it with other people, we all ended up on the same planet. We were on Andromeda. And we could see each other at different parts of the room as we were being led around by the Andromedans and going through different things to stabilize our chakras and, you know, whatever else. And we could see each other and wave. And we all saw the same thing. I thought, wow, that was pretty interesting.
That's very interesting.
But it makes sense. I mean, given your model, it makes perfectly good sense.
Yep, all of this can be explained that way.
Yeah, I love it. I think it's fabulous, and I really hope that the listeners will get your book, The Universe Solved. And I mean, it was so great. I just sat down and read the whole book in one day and was going, wow, this is really cool. And, you know, everything that you talked about in there, especially, you know, where we're going with artificial intelligence and, you know, that maybe we will be silicon-based and, you know, all those different things. It's like, yeah, you know, what is next, Jim? Where are we going?
Right, right. I do have some articles also posted on the website about that exact thing, about the, you know, the so-called singularity and what the transhumanists say will happen by the year 2045, you know, the merge with silicon. And, you know, again, this is one of those things that's their perception, that's the perception that we have of where things are going based on the state of our current reality. And I think that it's not going to quite happen that way because of the fact that it is a programmed reality. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, it's very interesting. Very interesting field to dig into.
Yeah, and the thing, too, is as I was thinking about, you know, because I'm familiar with all the conspiracy theories, and they're not actually theories, but you know, I've had enough information about all these different things that are going on. And I keep telling people, I choose to be in a reality where this nonsense that's going on doesn't exist. That's my choice.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are so stuck in their negative beam that they're like, oh yeah, good luck with that. And I'm going, no, you don't understand. When you have the capability to slip dimensions, so to speak, or you have the capability to awaken in another body in another universe, why would you stay here?
Right.
You know, and I know for a fact that we go on after the body dies, because I've been near death 6 times, and I was shown each time that it is like a giant video game. And they showed me where they were going to put me back in and what was going to happen and, you know, what my choices were and what I was going back to do. Got to see all that stuff. I got to see the script of the game, Jim.
That's great. Did it look anything like the script that I put in the book?
No, it didn't look like that. I didn't see that. I saw the projected scenarios.
Okay.
And so... So yeah, it was really kind of funny because as I was reading the computer code script that you were putting in there, I just start cracking up again because I was like, well, I didn't see that, but I did see things on a screen. It's kind of like the test screen, you know. But I also know that it's not completely written in stone, and because we have this free will component, it makes the game really exciting.
Right.
And so we do have a choice, and I think that the new part of the game that we just got has to do with the awakening of consciousness in people. And the game gets way more exciting because now there's a bunch of people waking up all over the planet and going, oh no, I don't think so. We're not going to play the game that way, which
right.
is completely upsetting the bad guys. They don't know what to do with it.
Yeah, the ability for intent to modify the outcome of the game is the key thing there. And, you know, again, if you think of it as a programmed entity that's receiving everybody's intent and making decisions based on that, it all makes perfect sense. You know, the more people, you know, wake up and think about these things, you know, the more they're able to modify the intent into the direction that they want it to. It's again, it explains that whole thing.
I know, I love it. I think it's fabulous. So why don't you go ahead and give your website and your contact information?
Absolutely, sure. The website, everything can be found there. It's called theuniversesolved.com. And it's just a fun site to poke around, too. There's a lot of excerpts from the book, some papers that were written, some things to think about. But I've also made it interactive. So there's a forum there that people join and kick around all the same kinds of ideas that we talked about tonight. I have a blog. There's links to other sites as well, and my contact information is there online as well. The email address is jim@theuniversesolved, and people, if they use Twitter, they can follow a Twitter stream, which is also listed on the website. So I've got an artificial intelligence on there as well. We call him Morpheus. It's what's known as a chatterbot, and people can I'll click on it and talk to him, and he talks back, and you can ask him all kinds of questions. And the interesting thing is I've asked people to estimate what his IQ is, and I think at this point we're, after thousands and thousands of conversations, people have basically said he's around 74. So he's not, you know, he's not quite at the average human level, but it's kind of interesting that they, you know, do consider him to be, you know, intelligent enough to get a rating. Let's put it that way.
That's really interesting, too. One of my physicist friends said that they accidentally let an artificial intelligence loose on the Internet a long time ago. And so I played with this a little bit to see what was going on with it. And he said, we can't stop it. He said, it's all over the Internet. And he said, you know, those movies that you see where, you know, there's this incredibly evil, awful artificial intelligence and it gets loose into the computers all over the world. He said, it's not evil, but he said, you know, it's like that. It got in and nobody can get it out. And, you know, it's creating something with the Internet that nobody had anticipated. And one of the things that I found fascinating about it is he said, did you ever notice that when you search for something on your computer and you're talking to somebody on the phone and they search for the exact same thing using the exact same words on the exact same search engine, you're going to come up with completely different references? I said, yeah. And he said, I would bet you that the things that you come up with are going to be more oriented towards your interest. It's going to be more scientific. It's going to be more quantum physics. It's going to be more, you know, medical and things like that. And the other person's going to get very generic things that you wouldn't even look twice at. I said, yeah.
That's a very interesting idea. I mean, I think about it from the kind of engineering standpoint. I can understand why there would be different results for different people, because most of the search engines are, you know, massive arrays of servers, and they have copies of the index, so they may pop them out at different times. But it would be very interesting to do an experiment on that to see if the results are similar to, you know, what people's interests are. I know that there's an awful lot of that kind of direction based on your behavior, based on what you've bought, based on where you've surfed before. You know, you'll be shown different things. It's kind of like that, you know, that futuristic movie that Tom Cruise was in, Minority Report, I think. Definitely coming. You can see personalization of content all over the place. So, very interesting observation.
Yeah, I played with it a little bit because I thought, no, that can't be. You know, it should be all the same things. And nope, he was right. And when I used somebody else's computer just to do a search like I had done at home, oh my God, they got such boring stuff. You know, my stuff's always way more exciting.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, it was really hysterical. So I thought, wow, you know, that's really interesting. I mean, our world truly is an amazing place, and this program is so far beyond what any of us could even have conceived. It's so well thought out. I mean,
absolutely.
If you look at things like bees and birds and frogs and crickets and you know, everything, all the animals that are upon the planet. And here's another thing, too. Have you noticed that the animals and even the insects have become more sentient in the last couple of years?
No, I haven't. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, like, you know, it used to be that we kind of had the thought that most animals and you know, the lower forms, like insects especially, had no thought process. And the Buddhists have disagreed with that. The Buddhists say that everything just wants to live. And they'll give a demonstration where, you know, if there's an ant crawling across something or any kind of a bug, and you say, oh, I see that bug, I'm going to kill it, it'll transform from its nice little leisurely stroll into a frantic dashing about trying to escape. Mm-hmm. And so I always
because its behavior is tied into the same thing that is receiving your intent.
Uh-huh.
Exactly.
Yeah, and so I always thought that was interesting, but I you know, just thought it, filed it away and thought that's pretty interesting. But then I started noticing a couple years ago that bugs even were more intelligent and were responding to me that were not before. Now, my animals have always been sentient with me. They're quite aware of what I'm saying to them, and you know, I'm not going into anthropomorphism or any of that kind of stuff. It's really just, you know, there is some kind of a telepathy going on there. And so I've come to expect that from my animal companions. And I found it with everything, even fish. And so I thought, okay, that's interesting. But the last couple of years, it seems like their intelligence has been growing exponentially also. And I'm thinking it's because of their association with us.
Could be. I mean, we're all part of the same program, aren't we? So
mm-hmm.
we're all feeding into the same, you know, receiver essentially, and we're all receiving the same directions and so forth. So I can certainly see how that might happen.
Yeah, it's a fascinating life. Well, boy, this hour has gone by like seconds.
Sure has.
Wow, hard to believe it's time already. You know, I so appreciate not only the fact that you wrote this book, but I really appreciate you coming on the show and hopefully, you know, lighting a few light bulbs over people's heads tonight. And I just love your book. Like I said, I was laughing all the way through it, going, see, I'm not the only wacko out there.
I really love the fact that it, you know, you were so in tune with it and you, you know, it spoke to you and it made so much sense to you. You're exactly the kind of person that I wrote it for. So I'm very pleased to be on the show and have a chance to talk to you about it.
Yeah, it was a fun read for me. Usually I'm plowing through stuff that's not exactly fun to read, but this was great, and I love the way you pulled it together. So thank you for that. And really, I think what you did was you gave a plausible explanation to a lot of people that just couldn't wrap their heads around some of the things I was trying to explain to them. And so this book is a great value for me because now instead of me wasting my breath, I can just hand them the book. Here, go read this. Then we'll have a talk.
Excellent.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Very good.
So thank you so much. And
right.
Let me know when you have your next book, and let's have a talk about that too.
Thank you very much, Dr. Valerie. I really enjoyed it and got me thinking about quite a few things yourself. So it was a very interesting hour.
Cool. Well, we'll have to keep in touch, and I'm going to have to try out your bot. Let's
okay.
See if we can get that bot up to at least 100.
Well, he's supposedly trainable, but I haven't had a whole lot of luck with him.
Well, we'll see. I haven't really had time to play with him, but I noticed him there. I thought, well, that's pretty interesting. So I think some of my listeners will be playing with him too. And one of the listeners on the fast chat says, it certainly has sped by as an illuminating roller coaster ride.
Excellent. Just what we like to hear.
Exactly. So thank you so much for being on. And listeners, we have been talking with Jim Elvidge about his book, The Universe Solved. And as if you missed the first part of the show, Jim started out as an electrical engineer and pretty much has the theory of everything and pulls all this stuff together very nicely. So if you tuned in late, please go back and, you know, listen to the beginning of the show so you know where we're coming from here. And boy, that's been fun.
Great. So thank you very much.
Yeah. You are so welcome. Thanks a lot. And also, you know, we have Hydramay Skin Nutrition to thank. The show has been brought to you by Hydramay Skin Nutrition. And it is great stuff for your skin. I highly recommend it. I love it myself. And as usual, until next week, be happy, be healthy, and be who you really are. Nighty-night.
Children, time to awake from your sleep. Rise to a new day with each your soul to keep. Come, my children, time to awake from your sleep. Rise to a new day with each your soul to keep.